Hey, so this is Jess. Here at Aloud, we value different perspectives on the issues of our day, and we explore various frameworks to better understand and deal with these issues. That being said, I'd like to clear up some of the language that you're going to hear in this episode. Eurocentricity has a long history of dehumanizing the other with weaponizing concepts like the noble savage and uncivilized. These words are important in understanding the foundations of modernism and white supremacy, and for that reason, they're valuable to include in the conversation, even though we know that they come from a place of hate and ignorance. There have been many states and civilizations outside of Western Civ, from the Aztecs to Chinese dynasties to the Indus River Valley civilization. Europeans of the past, and sadly people in this day, consider cultures outside of their own as not culture at all, but we know this to be completely, ridiculously untrue. It's important to me to address this so that you as a listener do not feel alienated from this conversation through the use of this language. I invite you to have a dialogue with the following material and, as always, consider carefully what you agree with and where you find fault.
Okay, everyone. Welcome back to Aloud. This is Brendan. I am joined by Jess, as always, and this week, or this time, we are speaking to my boy, Archer Thomas. Welcome, Archer.
Hi.
So a couple weeks ago, we kind of broached the topic of postmodernism, or as Archer might call it, POMO. And I thought, given that now has come up a couple times in a lot of different discussions without much background on kind of what postmodernism is, I could think of no one better to come on and maybe try to explain it a little bit than our own resident scholar in postmodernism. You are writing about modernism this summer, is that correct, Archer?
That is correct.
Yeah, okay.
You should catch me up on how far the discussion has evolved thus far, and then I'll tell you how you're wrong. So just catch me up.
Well, so really, I think as far as we've gone now is we were talking a couple weeks ago about postmodernism merely in the context of kind of the social unrest this summer, how we can understand the current movement as a postmodern movement. But obviously, even within this unrest, within the people engaging in this disobedience, I think the relationship to postmodernism and the knowledge about postmodernism, the ability and the kind of tendency to label any and all movements postmodern is lacking, and there's no real cohesion there. So I was thinking to catch
us
up. Yeah, exactly. Very postmodern on its own. I was thinking you can maybe catch us up by just giving a definition of the kind of core components or what makes up the ideology or lack thereof of postmodernism.
Okay. So postmodernism is a philosophical and artistic movement or group of movements that developed kind of in the post-war era, but especially in the 60s and 70s, that basically claims that there's no kind of real definite anything. So there's no kind of set moral rules, no way to truly evaluate art or culture as good or bad. No way we can truly know if anything's real. So it's just kind of like a kind of an all-around agnosticism about basically philosophy and culture. But yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so can you contrast that to modernism and what you would say are the defining characteristics of modernism and the modernist movement?
Right. So the modernist movement basically is a reaction to modernization as kind of a material process where, you know, the world has changed dramatically in the past couple centuries because of technology. So modernism claims that there are these kind of grand meta narratives of history. History is going somewhere. History has a direction. And that it's going towards something which is going to be definitely good and going to be, or if not good, it's going to be somewhere. And so So yeah, it has more direction and it makes more distinctions between good and bad and believes those things are knowable in a certain sense.
Mm-hmm. And how would it argue that those things are knowable?
Well, it would argue that it's knowable because, well, it's basically referencing history itself. So it would say that, for instance, we see that over the 17th and 18th century, all these absolute monarchies were brought down by violent revolutions, such as the American French risings of 1848. And so, you know, a lot of modernist historians or modernist historiographers or generally modernists would say, oh, that must mean that over time, the world is becoming more democratic and that eventually the world will be absolutely democratic or whatever. It's just a matter of time.
Hmm. So I think many people, in the nature of postmodernism, postmodernism can only exist on the back of modernism, right? So it seems like in many ways, postmodernism is a response to modernism and maybe, I don't want to say the failings of modernism, but people, obviously, there was a drift. So, and you say that postmodernism developing in this post-war era, but specifically maybe in the late 60s and 70s, at least as a kind of self-referential ideology, can you maybe speak to that moment of transition? What about modernism kind of caved in to give rise to a postmodern, don't want to call it revolution, but surge?
Right, exactly. Yeah, so I think that the really important thing that to emphasize is that there are postmodern aspects since the beginning of modernism. Like, for instance, if we think of postmodernism as very kind of self-referential, kind of ironic, like the first novel was Don Quixote de la Mancha. And so in Don Quixote, there's like the first volume of it, which most people know the story of. And there's a second volume, which is about Don Quixote himself reacting to the fame that he developed from the first volume when it was released. So it's kind of ironic and self-referential in a way that a lot of people would be surprised occurred in, you know, the 1500s in Spain. Mm. But so that's important that, like, you know, a lot of these postmodern aspects are a necessary kind of complement or kind of a yin-yang kind of dark side to modernism's light side, or maybe reverse, depending on how you view it. But in the post-war era, there was a specific kind of reversal of which was the dominant aspect within modern culture, whether it was modernism, postmodernism, because modernization as a process, which began, kicked off modernism, was basically, you know, complete. And by complete, I mean, of course, that's super generalized, because you'd be like, oh, well, there's still hunter-gatherer tribes today. Like, there's still, you know, people who, you know, aren't connected to world culture. But in my opinion, like, and this is kind of, you know, a lot of stuff I've been thinking about this past summer, but like, in order for modernism to kind of develop its ideology of constant progress, of, you know, this kind of forward thinkingness, there has to be something which is being changed. There has to be some sort of progress. Mm. And so the history of the past, you know, 500 years has basically been the expansion of, you know, industrialization, you know, modern agriculture, modern statecraft, things like that, until the 1960s or the 1970s, when basically every group of people in the world had become more or less assimilated into this modernized world culture, which now exists. And so if modernism kind of believes that there's some sort of like human nature which is being liberated by this kind of historical process, and that's kind of borne out by this modernizing process, which can be observed. When there's no modernizing process, you kind of lose track of where you are. And so therefore, the kind of like, after people realized, it was like, oh wait, like no one is free from culture, no one is free from world, you know, industry and world kind of world politics. Like the modernist project becomes kind of ironic and kind of like untenable. And so that's one of my pet theories about why the 60s and 70s.
So to what extent would you equivalent modernism with westernization? And I say this recognizing, you know, when you say West, there's automatically people who aren't the West, and that could create some kind of dichotomy that blurs out all the nuances and different groups that compose both sides. But at the same time, so much of modernity is tied with Western imperialism, colonialism, expansionism. What do you think of that relationship?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really, really big story, because I think the whole kind of narrative of modernism, as you said, a lot of it kind of needed this like uncivilized kind of alter ego to define itself. And so, you know, you see in the early 20th century, during the kind of, one could say, the heyday of high modernism, you know, these appeals to appeals in art and also in kind of philosophy to this kind of idealized form of, you know, people with mental disabilities or neurodivergent people, children, and then finally and probably most importantly, non-industrialized, non-Western peoples. And so the fact that they're kind of conflated as these kind of noble savages within society itself was a really interesting and very kind of like fraught aspect of modernism, I think, in the 20th century. Like for an example, I can give an example, like the surrealist movement of the art movement in the you know, the 20s, 30s, 40s in Europe. They were intensely interested in collecting African art, because so they would go, you know, they would work with dealers who would take these kind of ritual objects from Africa and bring them to Europe, and they would see these objects as, oh, look how like crazy the human mind can be, like this is like, you know, this is totally divorced from culture, this is totally original, like this is an example of like it, of like this kind of inspirational art that we can use to unlock this absolute kind of end of history state at the end of the modern narrative. But these objects were not free from culture. They actually were really, you know, they were actually had their own art styles that were handed down and tweaked through generations. And they were influenced by different cultures, even, you know, in Africa and stuff like that. So I think the question of, is modernism just a kind of outpouring of Western and Western imperialism? Like, I think it doesn't have to be, but it has been for a lot of history.
It's very interesting to me, and it reminds me of Notes of a Native Son, because given everything that's happening, right, and James Baldwin and his work has been on the center. And so I was reading his book, and one of the things he was talking about is we've, at least how I interpret it, we've tended to look at America, at least through the media, through academia, as this white land, right? And then it's the white people dealing with other people. Mm-hmm. But it's essentially at its core, it's this like white thing. And he was talking about how instead America is actually founded on a relationship between Blacks, between Natives, between immigrants of all places and white people themselves. And like that relationship is at the core of America, not necessarily one group. And I really liked what he said. And I would personally want to apply that to modernism and perhaps like what separates it from Westernization. Because to me, it makes more sense, right? Like if it wasn't for these people, these groups, their work, the industrialization process would have never happened, right? It's all connected. And I like that too, because it takes away the passivity or the lack of agency that we tend to attribute to these groups. And you also mentioned how modernism needed an uncivilized alter ego. Could you dip into that?
Yeah. So basically, you know, and this is kind of the topic of, this basically went into the nitty gritty of what I've been kind of studying this summer. But basically, central to the idea of modernism, and this is kind of articulated by Hegel and later by Marx, early Marx writings, including the Economic and Philosophical Manuscripts of 1844, which we stan. Basically, their kind of main kind of political relevance is that they believe that there is kind of this true self, which throughout, you know, history has been kind of, which has been obscured and kind of imprisoned by the power dynamics which exist in society. And so, for instance, like Marx says that one of the most important, you know, ways that this has happened is, for instance, when, you know, imagine you're working at a factory and you create a product, like the amount of money that you get on wages, that actually comes from the overall revenue, and the owners of the factory, just because they own the factory, get to decide how much of that revenue goes to you and how much of that revenue goes to the profit. And so because they own that, and also beyond that, because they own the factory, it is almost like they are the ones, we pretend as a culture that they're the ones creating the product. So they rob you of the ability to kind of connect yourself to the product of your labor, which Marx believed was a really important part of kind of defining yourself as a human being. And so this kind of relationship between worker and capitalist, once that is gone, he kind of believed that the point of history, the kind of narrative of history, was that that would eventually come to a contradiction that would be broken, and the human self would be able to be liberated. So the self is very important. And Hegel basically talked about the same kind of thing, but kind of more an idealistic way, and that's way more complex. I decided not to bring that up. But basically, as that kind of that idea kind of becomes more popular, that the self will be liberated by modernization, will be liberated by this new technology, will be liberated by history, the question becomes, what will the human being be like once it's liberated? What will the human being be after these contradictions which kind of society used to need, you know, including the relationship between masters and slaves, and you know, capitalists and workers, and feudal lords and serfs? What will human beings look like? And so a lot of artists and a lot of thinkers needed this kind of pure humanity, this uncivilized humanity, this humanity that was free from these contradictory relationships. And so a lot of these people, you know, you could say that they were naive and wrong, looked towards, you know, hunter-gatherer peoples, people who did not have, you know, the state system that we think of. And then also within society, like I said, neurodivergent people, children, things like that. So they needed to have these kind of like noble savages. They needed to have these people who were ignorant of culture in order to understand what humans might actually be like after this kind of liberating process of history.
So you put little air quotes when you were saying ignorant of culture. And that kind of reminds me as well as when you were talking about the pottery, or rather the African art, being in their minds, in the minds of these modernists, as divorced from culture. So is culture would these modernists consider culture to be civilization, and anything outside of that is?
Right. Well, a lot of these modernists, I mean, at worst, or one of the worst kind of tendencies they had was they thought of any culture that was not Eurocentric, or possibly kind of, or any culture that didn't resemble European culture, to not be culture at all. And so that's how they were able to kind of justify using these objects as examples of like an untrammeled, pure human self. But yeah, but like the thing that's kind of complex is like, even, you know, like I said, a lot of, you know, even people who live radically different than Europeans, of course, have culture and influences from all over. But also among like neurodivergent people, which is a big part of, you know, which is a big part of the research I did this summer, looking into a lot of art that was collected in the 1940s under the title of outsider art, or art brut in French. They thought that they were going to get some insight from, you know, if they went to asylums and institutions like these kind of things and collected the art of schizophrenic people and people with other mental disorders, disabilities, and things like that. But the thing is that even people with, like everybody, this is something we now appreciate, that everyone, even if, you know, they interact with the world differently, are also influenced by culture. And so, you know, that kind of is, that kind of puts a big wrench into this whole kind of ideological system. But yeah.
So I find it interesting here in this discussions of kind of modernism needing the noble savage to kind of understand where it's going. It seems like in the modernist kind of shtick for looking forward and kind of understand that history is progressing to a place, the fact that they can only reference that place, that liberated human self, by looking backwards, by kind of their own definitions, to people who have not yet industrialized or not yet, you know, been civilized, whatever that means. Is there not a sort of a contradiction there, that they're looking at this more as a cyclical nature as opposed to kind of a unidirectional telos, if that makes sense? And like, how does that kind of contradiction play out in the way that they kind of think about their own political ideological project?
Right. And I think this kind of goes into like one of the main kind of you would say it's a contradiction, but you could also argue it's not a contradiction within like Marx's own kind of thinking about this topic, is that in some ways Marx is the biggest fanboy for capitalism there is. Mm-hmm. He like spends a lot of time explaining why capitalism is better at doing a whole slew of things than any of the systems that came before it. But he also thinks it as like the worst thing that's also happened, because it's made kind of this oppression way more insidious and kind of hard to pin down. And so it's like, you know, this kind of contradictory ideas within the same idea, and like that's also reflected, of course, in conceptions of history, that in a lot of ways this pre-industrial peoples were seen as really ideal in a lot of ways, like in that they were seen as more in touch with their true selves and freer and blah 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 blah, but also they did not have access to all the good things that the fruits of technology and the fruits of, you know, an advanced culture. And so most of the modernists would say that it's not actually contradictory to be looking back to understand what will be like in the future, but actually it's important, because in the future we want to combine the best aspects of the pre-industrial peoples and the hyper-industrial peoples, that being combining, you know, freedom in individual fulfillment with material well-being and you know, just the amazing accomplishments that technology and medicine and all these other things have done in the past couple centuries. Yeah, so I think they wouldn't think that's a contradiction, but yeah.
And I guess the idea there is that as history kind of builds on itself, that endpoint, that kind of melding is inevitable, right? I guess that's one of the kind of core cruxes of modernist thought is kind of the, if you've learned from the lessons of history, if you see that these things kind of happen, this is how it goes, there is kind of an inevitability to the eventual kind of melding of, you know, the best of industrialization and the best of pre-industrialization. But it is our job to kind of get to that point.
Right. Yeah, it definitely kind of complicates like the individual's role in the history if you believe that actually history is kind of defined in a certain way. Mm-hmm. But someone would argue, like some like a lot of German idealists would argue that it's the role of the individual in history is more like there is some human nature, so history is going to be shaped by that, but within human nature you can do whatever you want. Mm-hmm. Which is a good thing, I guess.
I guess I'd ask there, or kind of going off of that, so in the transition from modernism to postmodernism, I think coming out, so post-war, this is, you know, in the turmoil, almost the unprecedented turmoil of the 20th century, there's this idea, whether it be kind of grand imperial ideological projects like, you know, the rise of the Nazis across Europe, or even mm-hmm. also in these kind of smaller scale anti-colonial, anti-imperial revolutions and like these grand kind of social projects that they embarked on, and the amount of failures that occurred, right? Like this kind of shaping history to this ideal point, this idea that you can kind of impose some vision of where history is going on the rest of the world because it's ultimately inevitable anyway. Like that is a hyper, you know, like violent and kind of just like hyper unstable form of tyranny. And coming out of that instability, there was a sense that like we need to kind of cancel out the surge of ideological projects wherever we can. And so it seems to me that postmodernism arose partly out of kind of the violence or the incompatibility of multiple different modernist visions kind of coming, you know, clashing with one another. And so I guess I'd ask there, as, I mean, I know, you know, you generally look down on postmodernism. What about that transition, having learned lessons from the 20th century, do you think was misplaced? Like, what were those kind of people who were dismissing modernism, what were they missing, if that makes sense?
Right. Yeah. So I think, you know, obviously, like, I agree that kind of postmodernism sucks, and I think a lot of people agree with that. But I also kind of feel that, like, in the present moment, you can't help but be a postmodernist. Yeah, which is right. it's difficult to like kind of go backwards in a certain extent.
Yeah, and I often feel like postmodernism kind of encompasses modernism. It eats itself alive. Any new thing that is any forward thinking vision that arises within postmodernism is automatically just encompassed or gobbled up by postmodernism itself, as it kind of accepts the inherent plurality of world visions that, you know, can coexist. And so there's almost like no way to escape it, right? Like even being a modernist in this age is to kind of be a modernist through a postmodernist lens. Mm-hmm. So continue.
So yeah, I think one of the main things that postmodernism kind of we lost during the development of postmodernism is that, so like I kind of said, like in modernism, you kind of have a conception of the true self. Like this is very important to be able to like see to like the idea that there is someone underneath all this culture and all this kind of experience and stuff like that. There is a human being. And then the crisis of modernization where, okay, there's basically no one who's not covered by culture. Now you realize that. And so after that, I think postmodernism kind of said, well, it looks like the self is now an irrelevant topic. And so you can really say nothing about any type of true self, because, you know, if we look around us, everyone seems to be a product of their experiences and a product of the culture surrounding them. And so postmodernism, in kind of denying the self, it set itself up for a lot of issues. Like, for instance, if we go back to the issue of, so in postmodernism, there's a big idea where instead of focusing on the true self, the only thing that we can really recognize that exists is the image of the self, the image that we can say, okay, like, this is, you know, all of the images which have assembled to create me or you or whatever. Let's focus on that. And so it's kind of created this kind of awful narcissism of, like, having this, of obsessing over the self, which isn't actually the person that you actually inhabit in your daily life. Like, the person that you inhabit acts effortlessly, acts according to their instinct, you know, acts according to their interest. But the image of the self is kind of this curated collection of, you know, of what you want other people to see you as. And that becomes the new locus of, you know, the individual in postmodernism. And, you know, a big issue with that is, as well as, like, how do class, like, so now that we're obsessed with, you know, the image, how do you even act in your own self-interest? Like, for instance, I actually think America is actually one of the least self-interested cultures on Earth. And the coronavirus pandemic is proving this, because a lot of people, because nowhere else have we had as many people who are reacting so strongly to wearing a mask or not going into a credit bar or whatever. Someone who's actually concerned with self-interest would say, okay, I'm going to wear a mask, or I'm not going to go to a credit bar because I don't want to damage myself. But Americans are incapable to do that, I think, because they actually don't have any self-interest. They're just obsessed with the image of self, and therefore they can't act in their own self-interested. They're selfless.
Interesting. Okay, so you're separating self versus this image of the self. Because as you were speaking, I was thinking, well, to me it's like a lack of logic, right? And reasoning and, like, critical thinking, and why people would act that way. Not necessarily like a lack of self-interest. I wonder how we can separate the two, or if we even should separate the two when it comes to your true self and self-image. Is the idea of, like, a true self constructed?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the postmodernist would say the true self is constructed and totally artificial and, you know, not located in your actual body or anything like that. And that's why you have to resort to this kind of, like, imagined sense. So basically, kind of, to think about this, it might be useful to kind of go back to Hegel, because Hegel's makes this distinction between objects and subjects. Mm-hmm. And so a subject is something or someone that thinks about something else and envisions something else. And the object is that thing that's being envisioned. Mm-hmm. And so the self, the true self, is a subject, and every other person, every object is an object. But if you think of yourself as a specific thing and you try to label yourself or try to curate yourself, you're looking upon yourself as if you're looking upon someone else or an object. You're making yourself into an object, you're objectifying yourself. Mm-hmm. And so this, in my sense, the second you begin trying to, like, define yourself, you actually lose any conception of who you are truly. And that's a big issue.
That's very curious. And it also makes me think, though, the benefits of doing that, right? And when I think of people today curating self-image, I mean, you could say, well, you know, it's not really them curating their self-image. It's what they've seen on TV and all their influences of who they should be. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, we've always had people put in boxes, right? Whether you're a king or a queen or a peasant or whatever the heck you were objectified and you were treated a certain kind of way. I think now, I would venture to say, like, the identity politic of being able to determine who you are, what that stands for, define that and alter your image or, you know, act accordingly to let the world how you want to be treated. I think that's a really powerful, liberating thing for many people. And I can see where it can go kind of weird, right? When you have people who are obsessed with the self-image and how that projects. Mm-hmm. But I think that the value of being able to stand up and empower yourself is outweighs the narcissism that could arise from it.
Right. I just want to add, like, as a question, I mean, it seems like a large part of modernism, I guess, disentangling modernism from kind of all the movements that went along with it is difficult. But, right, as you had kind of like an immense amount of work being published on, for instance, like class identity and like a strong, you know, sense of class conflict as being this determining aspect in society, or for instance, in kind of like this hype, the heyday of modernism also being kind of a heyday of like the nation state, right? And strong national identity. It seems like modernism very much informs those movements, but at the same time, it lays the bedrock for this postmodern objectification of the self, because with all of these labels that are, you know, have importance attached to them, whether it be, you know, I am a member of the working class or I am a member of, you know, X country, you automatically you have to then operate as if you are an object as opposed to a subject. And so this, like, the postmodern maybe objectification of the self, where everything is kind of you know, just a performance, you are an actor on a stage, is that not directly informed by the kind of, I don't know, the work of modernism and the idea that like everyone is playing a role in this historical trajectory, and therefore you are more than just a subject, you are an object participating with other objects in this great like kind of dramatic dance?
The hot seat.
Yeah, no, and that's kind of the issue of modernism has always had this kind of seed of postmodernism within it, because the second you like begin to have this historical narrative, you're like, oh, like I have just robbed my selfhood. Like I've kind of made myself, I'm thinking about my own place in the world as opposed to acting from my own instinct and my own interests. So this is the reason why I think everyone has to be a postmodernist nowadays, whether you like it or not, even though it kind of sucks, because of that reality. And it kind of goes back to, I mean, what your question about, like, you know, like identities and stuff like that. I would say the big difference between like the difference that has occasioned like identity politics is a change since the arrival of postmodernism, that I think there's a difference between having an identity and just acting as a human being because of that identity. Like, if, you know, like there's no kind of studied way to be that certain identity, versus kind of like thinking about yourself and being like, okay, I am this identity. This is part of this kind of like, you know, portrait which I've painted of myself, and then that influences my actions. Like, but I get that, like, feeling like you belong to a group can be really nice, but as a human being, is that really like, should it be something that's sought out? Like, this kind of need to be part of a group to define yourself, I think, is almost a it's almost a product of postmodernism.
I would say that the identities that we take on are less a matter of, oh, here's how I choose to define myself, as much as when I interact in the world, this is the way people are treating me, and this is how this is what I want to make of that, right? It's collecting these experiences behind a name so that we can identify them and, I believe, work towards something more beautiful from that. You see what I'm saying? Less of like, oh, you know, this is a group and like, you know, time to define myself, like, you know, become a part of this group per se. It's like, well, you're a part of something when you're born, you know, you're seen a certain way, you interact. And as social beings, like our humanity is largely defined by where we relate in society.
Right.
So I think in that sense, identity and claiming a group as part of your identity is vital, vital to having control over yourself. Or to give yourself control.
Right. Yeah.
Including those instincts that we talk about of the true self, you know, like I want to run, I want to play, I want to go to the lake, I want to paint. And then, oh, there are aspects of society that make that difficult or impossible.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And I, you know, I'm speaking just towards humanity in general, like over the years, there've always been aspects of society that have boxed people in.
Right. I think, no, I totally agree. And that's a big part of, you know, the experience of being a human being. I guess I would just say, you know, I wonder in postmodernism how it is important to do exactly what you said about like thinking about how identity groups, identity and a category's identity are tools to practice your self-interest. Like you said, I want to go on a run, I want to go to the lake, blah, blah, blah. How can I, in a lot of ways, identifying yourself with a group of experiences and stuff like that is a way that you can have a tool to make those things that you want to do happen. And that, I think, is well adjusted. And I think that is more in line with speaking through your true self versus, like, I think, you know, other, you know, forms of identity where possibly it's not actually in line with true self-interest. In fact, it happens to hinder it. Like, for example, with the mass debate, people who, as part of their identity, are, you know, basically being really kind of ridiculous with their own health and like endangering their body and things like that as kind of an assertion of their individual identity, which is bad, I think.
Could we call those anti-maskers rational individuals? Like, can you act in yourself
and think you're
not rational? And I hate to, I don't know, I always feel weird about using the word rational because I feel like it's become its own thing. And maybe you could talk to that as well, right? Like the ideas of like rationality and logic and like we have to act in the scientific method to arrive at this, you know. So I don't know, I'm not really sure where I'm going with this.
Go ahead, Brennan.
I was just gonna say that is definitely a crux of, or you know, a foundation, a cornerstone of modernism is like kind of the ascendancy of rational thought as being kind of a accurate roadmap to this objective truth, which we all should be unified in seeking, right? So I guess, yeah, kind of maybe backpedaling a little bit to the way in which this discussion we've been having links to those foundations of modernism. Yeah.
And I think with regards to like the rationality thing, that's really interesting just because. So like there's two arguments to say, you know, whether to like justify whether, you know, to justify why so many people are acting against their own interest in society nowadays. You can see that in a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. And one of those is because they're dumb or irrational or don't understand logic, or they're operating with a different kind of view of what it means to be an individual in society. And you could argue the first one, but I'm not so sure I'm willing to say that just like most people in society nowadays are just almost impossibly stupid. I'm not sure I'm willing to do that.
I would agree with that. Yeah, yeah. I retain some. I'm not such a cynic. I know it should surprise some people. But yeah. Right.
I don't know sometimes.
So Jess, do you think it's more likely that people are just like really radically dumb in society?
So, that's interesting. Because first of all, you know, what does it mean to be dumb versus irrational versus brainwashed following your own interests, right? And I suppose where I kind of a roundabout way to get at your question. I think that a lot of people are closed to possibilities that they don't immediately see in their life, right? Or that don't seem to apply to them. So that's why I think that postmodernism is helpful as a way of interacting with the world, as a way of learning about the world, to think, you know, maybe there might be other views. Because I would argue that these people are thinking from a very narrow viewpoint with almost blinders on. And that is the way I've come to see modernism. And another thing too, when I think postmodernism, I think of it as, you know, the plurality of ideas, but I feel like within that plurality, there are ideas that are better, at least according to my self-interest, right? But I feel like in general, the self-interest of one person may very well be in the self-interest of society, right? Like what's good for a tree is good for the forest. I suppose the question is then, how do you know what's good for the individual? Like, is that up for me to decide, right? And why would it be up to me to decide and not the anti-masker? But then if it's modern, if like modernism is the solution, well then who decides in modernism, right? Like what is the view, the lens through which we operate in society?
Right. I mean, that's the $1 million idea. I mean, and but like the thing what you said, like, I think it's important that there's a plurality of ideas because, you know, different people can interact different ways. That means that in that statement doesn't really actually value ideas as like ways to know things. It just values ideas about ways to not be like persecuted for your ideas.
Yeah.
Which is like very functional as opposed to like getting at the root of like what is actually going on in the world.
Let me elucidate that. I mean, it's important to have a pluralistic understanding of the world and of other people in the sense that we are open to the ideas of other people, right? That we're open to the fact that maybe we could be wrong. You see what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah. And I think that kind of humility can also be practiced by, in from a modernist perspective, in a certain extent. I mean, with like the kind of issues that we deal with on the day-to-day basis, as well as political issues, which are kind of small in comparison to these kind of massive issues that we've mostly been talking about. But like the idea of modernism is that there are just a few things which you believe in, like that you like have to believe in. And you know, the project of history is making sure that those beliefs are like, or like not making sure they're true because you know they're true, but like aligning the world with those beliefs. And people could say, that sounds, you know, awful, violent, but is that really worse than having a society in which people feel like they don't even have a sense of themselves? or you know, they're so up, they're kind of looking down on themselves. They're alienated. They're separated from their actual selves. Like, I think that's kind of a trade-off I'm willing to take.
Yeah, we talked about this 2 episodes ago, I think, when it was Jess and I, and not through the lens of modernism and postmodernism explicitly, but really just kind of about like the liberal order of our current world. And mm-hmm. one of the things I was getting at to kind of reiterate what we said before was that, like, and reiterate something I've also said earlier this episode, right? Like in the kind of failures and violence of the 20th century, like the idea that you believe in something and you are going to make the world align with those beliefs, because like if you believe in the good, like that is your obligation to do so. We saw like just how destabilizing that can be when you kind of have when power and when order, you know, always seeks to sustain itself. And in our current kind of end of history, like bipartisan consensus, neoliberal, you know, hegemony, whatever, like ideas about changing the world, any kind of radical vision, utopian vision, is inherently threatening. And that, of course, includes, you know, we try to push aside radicalism that we've learned to be dangerous and violent. But as we're seeing now, you know, what seems to us common sense reforms that are radical in the way they, you know, refute the current order, those are kind of marginalized and ostracized with the same veracity. And this idea that, like, in postmodernism, just as you are now defending against like the violence of and tyranny of ideas being imposed on the world by those you disagree with, it also is now a obstacle to you imposing, you know, your visions of the world. And again, this is, I think, one of the major kind of contradictions or crux in liberalism. And like in a place like the U.S., you have many people who are, you know, self-identify as liberal, right? They have, there's this contradiction between their idea of like, okay, everything is tolerated, everything goes, but also having very strong moral convictions. And when the world does not align itself with those moral convictions, there's an outrage, there's a kind of just like retreat into the self. Yeah. But when in this postmodern landscape, is our fear of kind of change, our fear of radical revolution itself, that is keeping us from creating that world that we envision. And that seems like one of the greatest kind of just like traps that we found ourselves in. And I guess, and all these discussions about, like, you know, is imposing your vision of the world, is truth, is believing in objective truth inherently tyrannical if you recognize that not everyone will, you know, believe in that truth? And if you believe in objective truth and you are not willing or able to make the world align with that truth or work to make the world align with that truth, then there's a kind of your self-actualization is threatened, right?
Right. You decouple your actions from yourself. You can no longer inhabit your body as a home, I think, when you don't, like, seek to change the world around your beliefs.
right.
Hey, Jess again, jumping in retroactively to preface the following. What we touch on next is one perspective of Black Lives Matter. I've had the pleasure to personally know many people who've poured their lives into civil rights work, both in the present and the past. I'm indebted to them. I respect their work and in no way want to discourage activists, while also recognizing areas for growth and elasticity, which are always necessary in a changing, fluid world. That being said, if you have feedback, commentary, or would like to speak on the issue, I encourage you to reach out to Brendan or I. Perhaps we could collaborate on future episodes. I also suggest listening to our second episode with Dr. Goss, where we discuss another viewpoint regarding postmodernism, Black Lives Matter, and its aims and successes. Without further ado.
I guess this kind of is an interesting transition. We were talking about kind of some of the current unrest we're seeing directed at many different angles, but there is kind of a, I think especially among young people, a skepticism or at least an inherent antagonism towards the power structures that be and all of these institutions. In what way, well, we talked to Dr. Goss a couple episodes ago about how this movement is kind of very postmodern, in that it is decentralized. There is not kind of a cohesive vision or cohesive utopian vision. And that is a good thing in the short term, in the way it builds coalition and allows people to kind of exert power on the world around them. But in the lens of modernism and postmodernism, how should we best understand this kind of crisis we're in? That makes sense.
I like, honestly, this is like a whole nother, like, this is so great. It's just a big topic.
Yeah.
So it's hard to, like, hard to say where to begin, but,
okay.
But I think honestly, this whole movement for racial justice and stuff like that has actually been hindered by the fact that it's not about, doesn't have actual aims. It doesn't, it's not in specific, anyone's specific interest per se. I mean, later that could come to the forefront, but right now, I think this movement appears like just as kind of illusory as a lot of things in the postmodern era of today. Like it won't, like I honestly think it won't actually resolve the issue of racial inequality in America, because that would entail a massive, you know, shift in the economic structure of the United States. And that's not what people are arguing for. And if it's not, it doesn't have those material aims, then what does it argue for except for this kind of small political victories, which are actually, you know, trying to capture the last little bits of these kind of last little bits of like behavior that can be modified slightly, like in police officers and stuff like that. Like, I don't know.
Right. I don't know. I feel like that bookends the movement too much, right? Bookends this moment, it isolates it in a sense, mm-hmm. from where it may fall in history and the ripple effects that it may have throughout society. When you think about all the myriad of ways, the many different ways in which things are influenced by other things, and just the incredible connections and like the webs of actions that any one movement may have.
Yeah, so you would say that actually this movement could possibly lead to dramatic social change because it might implant ideas in a new generation, would you say? Or
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, like as a consciousness raising kind of activity.
And our current generation as well.
Yeah. I mean, I also worry about the kind of consciousness that's being raised, because I worry that it's very focused on it's also very focused on image. And I mean, I think that most people would see this as a bad thing, that like people, the vast majority of people's engagement with it has just been posting on Instagram and admonishing others for not posting on Instagram. That's been a lot of people's engagement with it, which is too bad. And so what does that really accomplish other than gets people to vote for it to change these policies, which can only do so much? Because like, for instance, like would the policies that are being enacted now have saved George Floyd? Like, I don't know. It definitely wouldn't have. The policies being enacted right now definitely would not have resolved the racial tension in Minneapolis, because that's based in the fact that after the Civil War, ex-slaves were not incorporated into the economy and into society in the way that they should have been. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one thing to reiterate here is like, you know, in the current movement, it's not to deny the validity of it, or not to encourage it in its fullest form, but merely to recognize the ways in which, you know, as a postmodern project, it is maybe constrained in its
dreams, right,
or constrained in its dialogue. And I think that's, again, what we're getting at, like one of the really essential questions we find ourselves in, especially now as we recognize that, you know, this consensus, the end of history is breaking, or perhaps it was obviously illusory to begin with, but that kind of stability is maybe falling apart. We're seeing this ripple all across the world. How do we organize change? How do we direct change when we are now inherently skeptical and inherently antagonistic towards power or towards
narrative,
narrative, or the imposition of ideas on others,
right?
And I guess in that way, like, just to kind of defend the current movement, I think that over the course of this summer, you know, there have been intense call. I think more and more people are waking up to the structural nature of these issues. And of course, what we've gotten at before, and what we'll surely get at again, is as you recognize the structural nature of these issues, the kind of just like sheer magnitude of the injustice can be immobilizing. You have to, on a strategical level, direct your political efforts, direct your activism towards kind of specific facets of that problem, or else you will be kind of just like completely crushed by the sheer scope of it all. And I guess in that question, it's, you know, what is the best way to do that? Because as people, you know, over time find their energy challenged into specific fights, as we've seen postmodernism, this kind of just like this, you know, liberal consensus, the scope is very, very adept and in fact explicitly designed to kind of take those actions and incorporate them into the kind of the pre-existing institutions, and kind of commodify or co-opt activism, co-opt social justice and movements for change in order to keep them from getting too radical. And it seems like radicalism in terms of, you know, a full utopian vision is frankly impossible, given that there is now no way to, like, power is too deeply entrenched, power is too enshrined in all these institutional linkages that there's really no way to kind of take them on in one fell swoop. And that, I think the greatest thing that I've seen the unrest of this summer do, it will have material gains and we should applaud these when they occur, but I think it has sparked meaningful, especially among people in this generation, sparked really meaningful discussions about, okay, we all kind of are now in a consensus that like the enemy is so vast and our actions are so small. Like how do we confront that? I don't know.
Yeah, I think kind of, you know, you're talking about like how like radical movements, like basically all radical class politics, since all those movements who have tried to do that since the 1960s and 70s have failed. Mm-hmm. And why is that? Because, you know, they used to succeed, you know, somewhat regularly, if you're willing to think about, like, you know, massive labor movements and things like that, even in capitalist countries, as examples of class politics. And I think that part of that, yes, it's because power has become so big, but also going back to kind of Marx's formulation of alienation in the workplace, if you don't believe in the self, if you don't believe you can come in contact with that, then the idea that, you know, that you have a right to the products of your own labor, that is part of yourself, that working is a natural, like, integral part of having a true self. If you don't believe in the self, you can't sympathize with that. Like, you can't actually, well, I would say that you probably still could feel it, but you can't articulate it. You can't, class oppression is no longer this kind of palpable feeling, because the self no longer exists. And so, yes, like, power is big and stuff like that. But if I think more people had a better conception of their self and of self-interest, then a lot more people would realize that radical change is in their self-interest. So, like, you know, and it's, so that's why it's so sad to watch the decline of a lot of, like, traditional kind of, you know, workers' parties, labor parties, unions, and various other kind of class conscious organizations and kind of outpourings of class consciousness and generalized consciousness about one's place in society. Because I feel like actually, because if you don't have a self, that the new consciousness that is going to raise is kind of false, and it's not actually kind of coming into contact with this kind of equation of alienation that was formulated by Marx in the 1840s.
Ooh, you touched on a lot there. Both of y'all did. I feel like to call these movements a failure, or even the ones of the 60s and 70s. Isn't operating on a reasonable time scale. I don't think so. Because, like, you know, Great Wall of China wasn't built overnight. It takes a long time for things to come together, to coalesce. And we think of, like, even first, second, third wave, fourth wave feminism, you know, all the different variations and iterations of a struggle. I feel like it's all one continuation.
But so far, like, I mean, if you look at the, you know, charts of, like, kind of personal well-being and inequality in society, like, they've gotten worse. Like, inequality has gotten worse in countries almost consistently since the early 70s. And deaths of despair over the past 30 years have gone up dramatically. So, like, yes, there's, like, possibly these movements are coming together into some, you know, great victory, but 50 years is a long time. Like, I don't know. And it, a lot has changed. And despite that, you know, like, for example, like, the earnings of a like a Black family in the United States was actually, there's the gap between Black and white families' wealth was actually greater in the 1970s and 1950s. And so it just seems like, okay, what is it going to take? And I think it has to be a different sort of consciousness. It has to be, you know, a new sort of a consciousness that maybe recalls modernism.
Yeah. I mean, Jess, I guess I would ask you, I mean, certainly sympathetic. I think any and all movement, any action you take to, you know, bring about material improvements in your own life is a success on some level. And I think certainly there have been many good fights fought, you know, in this postmodern era, late 60s onward, a countless number of good fights and important mm-hmm. fights.
For sure.
And incremental progress is made. But when you hold it up to kind of these broader societal changes, I guess I just ask you, like, what, and Jess, what do you think are kind of these the fights that have mattered most within the scope of postmodernism, and are we being too quick to dismiss them?
I think there's a lot that we have to celebrate and to look towards. You know, like the fact when we were growing up, gay people couldn't even get married.
Yeah.
That's pretty ridiculous, right? You know, growing up, my mom couldn't go to school with white people. Yeah. Things like that, of that nature. There's still so many problems today. And you reflected them quite well in, you know, some of the different points that you made and brought up. But I feel like at the same time, there are a lot of good things that are going on and that are coming on. I don't want to say it's a matter of what you focus on, right? Because obviously, like, I don't want to dismiss any of the realities that are happening. but I wouldn't be quick to say it failed or that it's even failing. I think it's a work in continuation, all of it. And I think that that expansive mindset is necessary to maintain hope and to learn. Now, perhaps one could say, well, you know, we can move forward, create a new movement that's better than this last one, you know, taking the best parts of it, right? Like hearkening back to aspects of modernism or looking at revolutions that worked like that and had everything changed. But I feel like it's possible to acknowledge change, acknowledge what worked, acknowledge where things are going, and run it like a continuous book as opposed to like closed scenes. And I think that that's necessary to sort of capture the full extent of what's going on. Because otherwise, who knows what we're closing out, right? You may say, oh, it didn't work because of, it didn't work, it failed. But then look at all these other things that happened, right? How can we account for that if we're not even going to include them in the movement?
Yeah.
When we don't know how they're related or how they could be related.
Yeah.
Because of the nature of connections, the nature of, you know, this web of a world.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess on that point, I mean, I think as we acknowledged with, you know, modernism containing the seeds of postmodernism, and to be a modernist in postmodernism is to in some ways be a postmodernist yourself. Certainly it's like you, everything that has happened, every fight that has been waged informs the subsequent fights, and as material conditions change, whatever those changes may be, you know, any fight, any struggle that commences after the fact is obviously predicated on that initial shift in conditions. But I guess, you know, the question is, when we think about our next fights and we think about the fights that we have to wage, where do we, like, what kind of vision do we center ourselves in? Where do we, what do we learn from? What fights do we learn from? Yeah. What fights do we consider to be truly successful? And I guess, yeah, as Jess, you just brought up, like, that is obviously such a complicated, it's different for everyone, and everyone is going to fight for slightly different causes, slightly different reasons, and that's maybe inevitable. But I don't know, yeah, I think really some really essential questions. Archer, if you want to maybe speak to that briefly. We have to, I know, wrap up. Jess, you have to get going.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously there's been a lot of changes even in our lifetimes. Like, that's great. But I do wonder if, like, is life really getting better? Like, is it better for our souls? Like, I'm a little more suspicious of that. Like, yes, people can do things that they were never able to do before, but I think I look at society and I see a society that is more that is more narcissistic, that is more fatalistic, that is, you know, less able to articulate its own ends than ever before, and that terrifies me. And I think, so that's kind of my sense of things. Although, yes, okay, there has to be, you know, this kind of sense that, like, all things are a work in progress, but I think there also has to be some sort of, like, there has to be some way you can say that that you can say that all these things are connected into one specific project, and it has to be, I think, based in a belief that you think is true above all else. And so it's based in faith, and it's I think that denying that is not doing ourselves any favors, because all of us is making ourselves more atomized, you know, and you know, unable to articulate ourselves. But yeah.
I suppose I wonder, Archer, is this truth something that exists in the past, where we go back in time to, you know, scrap together a similar mindset? Or is this a truth that we'll achieve by pushing forward, by moving forward, from taking what's valuable from the past, but creating something new. You know, would modernism, again, be the answer, or will it have to be some kind of post-postmodernism, some entirely new creation? You know, like everything that's built with what preceded it,
yeah,
but is inherently unique and different.
I mean, I think the lesson of all of this is that we can't go back. We can't go to the past. However, you know, if we want that, we don't want that. It's impossible. And so, you know, modernism tore down the values of the world that came before it, the pre-industrial world. Postmodernism tore down the values of modernism. And now we've torn down so much of modernism that I think we're going to have to start tearing down postmodernism. I don't think it's going to look like modernism. I think it's going to be something completely different. And it's going to be exciting.
Well, hear, hear. I look forward to watching this new epic come into fruition with both of you offering your insightful commentary on the side, as always. I think we can maybe leave off there.
Awesome. Well, thanks for having me.
Yeah, Archer, thank you for being on.
Yeah, thank you.
I will see you soon.
Yes.
Yay. And Jess, I hope I can see you soon too. These atomized Zoom meetings from across multiple different states are taxing. If this is a hallmark of a new epic, then I would like to go back, even if it's impossible. All right. Well, Archer, thanks for being here. Signing off. Hi, all. Coming off of that discussion, I want to leave you with a passage from Alejandro Zayeropoulos' The Politics of the Envelope, as quoted in Zizek's Living in the End Times. There is a growing number of new forms of political action which herald both the emergence of different political qualities, such as effects, and domains, such as everyday life. Contemporary politics are giving way to a new wave of powerful material habitats, artificial environments, artificial organizations, belongings, and attachments, which are literally redefining political surroundings in which we are and coexist. Both governmental agencies and corporate organizations are moving towards multiple layers of governance with intensified connections between them. As a result, the challenge to power can only be selective, and a division of political labor has to be addressed by multiple disciplines operating independently and simultaneously. A singular politics of resistance is no longer capable of challenging contemporary forms of instituted power. Have a good night, y'all. See you next time.